Good morning. Welcome to Prairie Unitarian Universalist Society. My name is Christina Clack, and I'm a member here at Prairie, and I will be your presider today. Prairie aspires to be both an open-hearted and an open-minded congregation. We welcome people of every ethnic and religious background, whatever your color, sexual orientation, gender, or family structure. We welcome you no matter what your age or your abilities or your inabilities. Today, David Giffey will be presenting a service entitled Military Service and Religion, Should They Coexist? And I shall be presenting David Giffey in just a few minutes here. Before we do our opening words today, I would like to introduce our speaker because David will actually be providing our opening words. David Giffey has decorated Greek Orthodox churches in the U.S. and Greece with icon murals in the traditional Eastern Christian style. He also painted many murals permanently installed in community centers, schools, and other public buildings. A lifelong journalist as well, for the past 6 years, he has worked as editor of the Home News Weekly newspaper in Spring Green. He is a veteran of the Vietnam War, where he was combat journalist with the Army. And he is a founding member of Chapter 25, Veterans for Peace. David and his artist wife, Nancy, live in rural Iowa County. And now David will come and read our opening words.
This is from a piece called The Chance for Peace, delivered to the American Society of Newspaper Editors on April 16, 1953, by President Dwight David Eisenhower. Every gun that is made, every warship launched, every rocket fired, signifies in the final sense a theft from those who hunger and are not fed, those who are cold and are not clothed. This world in arms is not spending money alone. It is spending the sweat of its laborers, the genius of its scientists, the hopes of its children. The cost of one modern heavy bomber is this: a modern brick school in more than 30 cities. It is two electric power plants, each serving a town of 60,000 population. It is two fine, fully equipped hospitals. It is some 50 miles of concrete pavement. We pay for a single fighter with a 500,000 bushels of wheat. We pay for a single destroyer with new homes that could have housed more than 8,000 people. This is not a way of life at all, in any true sense. Under the clouds of war, it is humanity hanging on a cross of iron.
It is time for our presentation. It says presentation and singing, so that's something to look forward to. The title is Military Service and Religion, Should They Coexist? And we will welcome back David Giffey.
Thank you, Christina and Dan and everybody who helped corral me for today. The official title on the program of my presentation, and can I be heard okay?
Yes.
Is Military Service and Religion, subtitled Should They Coexist? There are further subtitles, and I'm going to read those. Two more. One is, can religious practitioners follow their beliefs and participate in warfare in good conscience? And the second one is, do the spheres of military service and religion intersect, and should they? I'm really delighted to be here. I have a great deal of admiration for this community. I was here one other time, many years ago, and I can't even remember what the topic was. But I was, in talking to Christina, I assume it was approximately the same, because there always is a need for discussion of the intersection or not of many things, including religion and the military. I will also say that this community really knows how to give difficult assignments to speakers. The topic today is one that begs for much more attention than it receives. So please bear with me as I try to examine it from my perspective with what I hope, at least hope, is interesting, if not informative. I'm a veteran of the war in Vietnam, as Christina mentioned. I was there in 1965 and 66 after being drafted. I worked as a combat journalist and a photographer with the 1st Infantry Division. In retrospect, my title more accurately should have been propagandist. Although I was raised in a Roman Catholic family, by the time I was deployed to Vietnam, I wasn't actively participating in any religion. During those years, we heard a lot about, and we still do, this old cliche, there are no atheists in foxholes. Well, that's nonsense. Maybe we weren't atheists, but the experience of war, to my knowledge, never converted someone into a spiritual creature. I was only nominally Christian at that time. Years later, after what can only be described as a spiritual pilgrimage, somewhat necessitated by my experience in war, plus other inner yearnings, I traveled the world and spent time learning about and attempting even to practice Eastern religions, primarily Hinduism. I then, believe it or not, by a Hindu Swami, was introduced to Eastern Orthodox Christianity, because the people of the East commonly have a much more universal and more broad understanding of the world's religions and many things than do we in the West. And Eastern Orthodox Christianity, from my first contact with it, it really spoke to many of my spiritual longings, and I have since been very closely allied with Eastern Christianity, primarily in the Greek Orthodox Church. As an artist, I subsequently studied the most traditional of Christian art forms, that being iconography. And I spent decades decorating Greek Orthodox churches with icon murals in the United States and in Greece. I've simultaneously worked as an artist, a writer, and a photographer for most of the past 50 years. And for the past 6 years, as was mentioned, I've been the editor of a newspaper, which I haven't touched a paintbrush in those 6 years, except to paint an occasional protest sign. Regarding religion and the military, I feel that our culture has fostered some very deep misunderstandings that have muddied our ability to distinguish between the two. One of those misunderstandings manifests itself in an American militaristic tradition, which certainly affected my young life. My family, like many others, included generations of military veterans. My grandfather was a Civil War veteran in the Union Army from Fond du Lac County. He was wounded and captured and spent time as a prisoner of war. His service began before he was legally eligible, age-wise. And his mother received probably $200 or $300 from somebody who had been conscripted and paid his family as a substitute. Both of my older brothers were in the Army. One was during the occupation of Japan after World War II, and the other was in the Army during the Cuban Missile Crisis. In my view, the American militaristic tradition and its twin buzzword, patriotism, have reached nearly religious status in our society for a variety of reasons, which are a separate topic, really, from our topic today. Suffice it to say that the notion of patriotism, if it isn't really carefully examined and explained and understood, which can ennoble it, but if it isn't, it approaches cult status, as many of us will be able to observe tomorrow if we happen upon any of the Memorial Day celebrations, aside from the one that Veterans for Peace is sponsoring at James Madison Park at 1 o'clock tomorrow afternoon. Matt Rothschild will be our speaker, the editor of Progressive Magazine. We call it an alternative Memorial Day service. So my answer to the first question of our topic, should military service and religion coexist, is yes. I feel that they must coexist. Their coexistence isn't really a philosophical matter at all. It's simply practical. In our world, religion exists and the military exists. Some sort of coexistence must occur. There seems to be no option. As for the second question, can religious practitioners follow their beliefs and participate in warfare in good conscience? My answer to that is no. To explain, I will refer to teachers and theologians in the Eastern Christian world, which I realize may be a somewhat limited kind of source, but it's important to understand something about Eastern Orthodox Christianity before you leap to judgment about that. Eastern Christianity, while it is the original form of Christianity practiced continuously since the third or fourth centuries of the Christian era, is not a fundamentalist evangelical religion as we know those to be. The Eastern Christian Church throughout its history has reached conclusions by consensus through ecumenical councils and so forth, and embodies a living tradition which is equal to Scripture. While it is certainly Christian in its beliefs, the dogmatic, doctrinaire attitudes commonly associated with some parts of Western Christianity were invented by the West. And when I say the West, I don't mean Los Angeles. I mean the Church of Rome. Martin Luther didn't nail his treatises to the door of an Eastern church, but to a Roman Catholic church. In fact, Eastern Christianity was untouched by the Protestant Reformation, and it considers the Roman Catholic movement itself to be the first Protestants. So if we think about religion and military service, there's the inevitable mention of the just war theory, right? We've all heard of the just war theory. And if you haven't really thought about it much, you've probably spent a lot of time scratching your head trying to figure out what it meant. That theory, along with interpretations of how we can respond to controversial issues, have been examined and argued about for centuries in Eastern Christianity. As my Greek friends like to say, wherever there are two Greeks, there are three opinions. And that holds true, even within the framework of the church. Father Stanley Herricus, which is a name you would be well advised to remember if you're interested in following through on research on this, he's a distinguished theologian and an ethicist, and a contemporary writer who has examined the church's stand on those controversial issues, including, you know, technology, sex, euthanasia, politics, war, all those perpetually controversial issues. After his lifetime of research on the principles of war, Father Herricus concluded that there is no just war theory contained within the teachings of Eastern Christianity. He wrote that he initially rejected pacifism when he was young, until he began to learn about reasons why the Orthodox Church law, canon law, exempted the clergy from military activity, prohibited, in fact, the clergy from military activity. He said that the clergy was strictly prohibited even from entering military camps. And the reason was it was an effort to maintain an ideal standard for the clergy that was not applied to the laity. Then he began to realize that none of the Western ethical views, beginning with St. Augustine, were part of the Eastern Church at all. In other words, the just war, unquote, concept was completely a Western point of view based on Western ethics. Not only did he fail to find anything about just wars in his research, but even good wars were absent. And things like crusades were utterly impossible. So he came to feel that war was taught in the Eastern Church to be considered as a sometimes necessary evil. And it was very difficult to define or describe beyond that. He kept studying, though, until he concluded that the teachings in the Eastern Church were actually pro-peace, making them different from the responses to war in the West. From there, he concluded that the Eastern Church couldn't have theories about just wars because just wars don't exist. Unlike the West, where war can be rationalized as just, in the Eastern Church, war remains a necessary evil. Nothing can be done to make war positive. And so, no just war theory is valid. As I see it, that places all of us, particularly those of us who are allied with the Eastern Church, it gives us the responsibility to make some very, very important personal decisions. As I mentioned, it's not a doctrine, but the requirement that we realize, that we analyze every single aspect of the world around us and make choices based on what we know to be peaceful and just. That's our mission. Had I been taught these ideas about Christianity and war earlier in life, I would not have allowed myself to be sent to what I came to realize was an unjust invasion and occupation in Southeast Asia. I often feel that had a person whom I respected, because I was relatively political aware, I thought, in the early 1960s when I got drafted, if someone had really spoken to me about what was going on, had we known, of course, it wasn't well known then, I would have been eagerly on a bus to Canada. So my answer to this final question would be, yes, the spheres of military service and religion intersect, but no, they should not. And where do these conclusions lead me? Since returning from the war in Vietnam, I have attempted to actively participate in peace and justice movements. That has led in many directions and included working as a journalist with the migrant farm worker labor movement, as a teacher and artist in the African American community here in Madison, as a counter recruiter, attempting to present alternatives to young and vulnerable teenagers and minors in high schools with Veterans for Peace. I do that work. As an artist exhibiting peace-themed work and a writer and editor of publications like Long Shadows, Veterans Paths to Peace, which I brought along today. There are some copies out there available for sale if you're interested. In my church community, Assumption Greek Orthodox Church here in Madison, with mixed results, admittedly, I advocate against war, and I taught Sunday school there for many years. Paying attention to spiritual things in and of itself is sometimes incorrectly couched in terms of opposition to the secular democracy. I'm sure you've heard that, or maybe even felt that yourselves. This is a mistake, I feel. But our personal spiritual longings do not break down the obvious need for a separation between church and state. So rather than quoting Eric Prince, the guy that founded Blackwater, or Pat Robertson or George Bush as examples of people in religious groups, peace activists in churches refer to the more lasting examples of teachers like Dorothy Day, Gandhi, and the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King. I've been involved with a group called the Orthodox Peace Fellowship. It was founded by a friend of mine, Jim Forrest, who spent a year in federal prison in the 60s after, so the word was desecrating draft files in Milwaukee. And he then, as I, converted, so-called, to Eastern Christianity. He now lives in Amsterdam and is the International Director of the Orthodox Peace Fellowship, which is a group that brings together writers and theologians from within the Eastern Church discussing issues of war and peace and justice. I've been involved with that group, and a few years ago I read an essay by a member of the Orthodox Peace Fellowship that was very dismissive of the anti-war movement during the 1960s. And said they were invalid because of, you know, the usual stereotypes. Everybody, it was all about sex, drugs, and rock and roll. and who said that the peace movement of that time was actually responsible for the mistreatment of veterans and polarized the country. Two of the most easily overcome arguments from those of us who experienced both the war and its aftermath and the peace movement. Those arguments don't hold any water in my view, but that's what his claims were. And those comments prompted me to write a rebuttal to that. And in closing, here's a little bit of what I wrote. Before renouncing participations in public demonstrations against war, I think it necessary to examine our motives. As Abba Evagrius was a 4th century Greek monk and a theologian. As Abba Evagrius said, "Do you wish to know God? Learn first to know yourself." I participate to the best of my ability in the peace movement. At demonstrations, I am sometimes asked to serve as a peacemaker, wearing an armband and walking along the edge of the crowd where demonstrators are most likely to be attacked. It's an easy and a safe job. Only a couple times over the years have I stepped in front of people who seemed angry. They were always people who seemed like they might attack the demonstrators, never the other way around. The quest for peace is an inner journey, but to deny participation in the outward manifestations of the peace movement as unworthy or impure seems to me a denial of our very humanity. I always pray when I'm marching for peace. I don't know if my colleagues are praying. I can't judge that. I do know, however, that they are conducting themselves peacefully and bringing attention to the constant need for peace. If we were bystanders along the paths of Galilee, and we saw great crowds following Jesus as described in Matthew, would we be creating division in society if we followed the crowd to the mountain and listened to the speaker say, "Blessed are the peacemakers, for they shall be called the sons of God"? And even if society were divided at that moment, would we be forgiven if we stood by like Pontius Pilate and did nothing on behalf of peace? Thank you very much. And I. I would be happy now to listen to a discussion or participate in it. Before we begin, I just want to point out I brought two visual aids here. There's nothing more than that. One is a photograph of a dove mound, which I designed some years ago, which is located at the High Ground Veterans Memorial Park in Clark County. It's, of course, based on and inspired by Native American effigy mounds. It includes, when it was built, amazing things happened, and it's there today still. It was built in 1989 by a group of 200 or 300 volunteers. And it includes samples of earth from all over the world, including Vietnam, all the counties of Wisconsin, many other places. And it led to my return to Vietnam in 1995 with a delegation led by Mike Boehm of the Madison Friends Committee. We dedicated Vietnamese American Peace Park north of Hanoi. And a dove-shaped earthen sculpture was placed in that park as well. This is simply a photograph that I took during my time in Vietnam. One of many. Photographs like that inspired a series of paintings that I've done. And this shows a Viet Cong prisoner of war being interrogated. At that time, it was common for prisoners of war to be turned over to South Vietnamese military for summary execution, absolutely contrary to the codes of international codes of warfare. And beyond that, I'm willing to answer questions or to ask them. Thank you. That's a perfect question. that's probably the second most difficult job I have, in addition to speaking at your to your community. I've taken it upon myself to try to gain access to high schools in my part of the state. So far, I've been successful in about 6 or 8, I would say. And it's a complicated history and to tell about what is really happening, but it goes something like this. In 2001, George Bush signed what's called the No Child Left Behind Act, and there's a 180-word section, Section 9528, I believe it is, that gives the military carte blanche access to student data, high school student data, upon request. So, and you can count on the fact that they take advantage of it. So the military writes a letter to the principal and requests the student data, and they send it. That happened for years and years until we started to push back, basically, calling that an invasion of privacy. There have been federal court decisions historically from 20 and 30 years ago that say that the military's presence in schools, the recruitment presence in schools, which would be shocking to you if you knew about it, is controversial. And therefore, alternative points of view are legitimately and legally presented. But boy, try doing it. I mean, and one of the problems is we have 424 school districts in Wisconsin. Every single one is different in regard to those kinds of issues. They do have policies. Some of them have policies, and it's the policies have come about because we have insisted on cultivating them. Policies about opting out. This section I mentioned in the No Child Left Behind Act also says that the only way that the student data won't be turned over is if the family or the student chooses not to allow it. But you can imagine how difficult that is. Every single district is different. The school district I live in initially sent stuff off willy-nilly until I complained. Then they did write a policy. Now they give the students, they send a letter to the parents saying, you have 30 days after school starts in the fall to opt out, otherwise your data is gone to the Pentagon. That's not uncommon, believe me. I mean, that's some give less time. Some don't do it at all, unless somebody requires them to do it. I have been in schools like Reedsburg, Dodgeville, Richland Center, Darlington, Boscobel, Wisconsin Heights, the River Valley, which is Spring Green, and it's news to them. Now, what we have to do, and I've written a paper about it, a little sheet, and I probably didn't bring them, but I could provide them in the future. What I tried to do is describe how to counter-recruit. Unfortunately, for better or worse, veterans are seen as legitimate people to do that. I don't claim to have any special skill or knowledge or anything, but if a parents group even, or a 4-H club or somebody went to the principal and said, we want to counter-recruit and try to talk to young people about not going in the military, they would get laughed at. But a veterans group, we as a veterans group have that. We also work with Code Pink. We work with any peace groups in areas that are willing to help us. We have table displays, visual displays, handouts of all types for the kids, one of which looks just exactly like an Army recruiting pamphlet, and it says, do you know enough to enlist? We have a book, a wonderful book. It's a graphic history of war. It's called Addicted to War. Howard Zinn was involved in it. So there are many pieces of literature. The American Friends Service Committee has been incredibly helpful in this, but it is an uphill struggle. Some years ago, there was the focus of the military recruitment was on minority groups in urban places. That has changed utterly. It's the predominantly white rural school districts now that are just being bombarded with military recruiters because they get pretty good educations. The graduation rate is astoundingly high, like 100%, and they don't have jobs. And so they're the fairest of game for cannon fodder. So now we're focusing our attention on that, but we have no resources. The Pentagon spends, their budget last year for recruitment was $7 billion for recruitment. It costs about on average $30,000 to $35,000 to get one kid to sign up. They come into the school shops with Humvees to repair, and they have obstacle courses and trailers, and they give them T-shirts and make them do push-ups and stuff. I mean, it's just bizarre what the recruiters do, and they spend untold sums of our money to recruit our children. So I sympathize utterly with you. I know that it's a horrible situation. That's why else would I have gone in the military had it not been kind of genetic? You know, it's unfortunately there in our culture, and ferreting it out is if I can help in any way, I will be happy to do that, and I'll talk to anyone who wants that help afterwards. But every district that I go to, I have to go through all the hoops, you know, the superintendent and the principal. The crux of the matter is through the guidance office. If you can befriend them, and occasionally they're somewhat sympathetic, then you can usually. Oh, you mean the Orthodox Peace Fellowship?
Yes.
Oh, absolutely. Yes. Jim Forrest, the man that I mentioned, who is the director, has written books about the conflict there and has spent a great deal of time there, actually, attempting to foster some kind of, you know, unification or amelioration of the terrible circumstances there. Yeah, they are involved. It's an area that I traveled through Bosnia, my wife and I did, some years ago, just before everything blew up. And so, you know, I haven't spent a great deal of time even studying the area, but Veterans for Peace also has consistently opposed conflict. The real mission of Veterans for Peace, when we invite people to join, we have a little application in it, and the mission ends with a statement about our goal is to bring about the abolition of war. So we don't discriminate about which wars we want to abolish. Right. That's a good point. And I'll just make one very quick comment. The intersection of military service and religion is really complicated now, even within the Orthodox Church, because there are so-called military chaplains who are kind of embedded in the military, almost like journalists. You know, and in my view, the moment that a chaplain, a so-called, whose duties are to give spiritual solace and so forth to people on the battlefield, the moment they put on a uniform, they lose all their validity as in that role. Very similar to journalists who are embedded, and you can't tell the journalists from the military. You can't tell who's who, and they're supposed to be writing about the people that they look like. We're working. Actually, I'm in close contact with the president of the building trades unions in South Central Wisconsin, and we're now gonna. That's one of the keys, because it's not enough to go into schools to say don't join the military, even though the reasons are perfectly valid. But we need substance, and so the apprenticeships and things like that are where people can learn and be paid while they're learning and get good jobs and replace the people who are retiring. And if they don't like their job, they can quit without going to jail, which isn't true in the military. I know that there's a time issue. I'd be so happy to speak to people afterwards.
Thank you very much, David. Our closing words today will be provided by David Giffey.
These are verses from the second book of Isaiah. It shall come to pass in the latter days that the mountain of the house of the Lord shall be established as the highest of the mountains, and shall be raised above the hills, and all the people shall come. He shall judge between the nations and shall decide for many peoples, and they shall beat their swords into plowshares and their spears into pruning hooks. Nation shall not lift up sword against nation, neither shall they learn war anymore.